Well, I would say have a seat, but you guys are already sitting. Welcome to Veritas. You guys are probably all thinking, hey, that's not Nick, and you're right. Nick actually was at a conference this week for the Acts 29 network that we're a part of, and he and his family took a much-needed vacation down in North Carolina, and so keep them in your prayers that it would be restful and that they'd come back energized and that they wouldn't just keep on going south and end up in Mexico somewhere. Well, I'm very excited to have the opportunity to teach you guys, and we're going to be continuing on in the Sermon on the Mount. For those of you that this is your first Sunday with us, we've been spending about the past 2 or 3 months, really since we launched in October, going through the Sermon on the Mount, and we've gotten all the way into chapter 6, and we're going to be talking today a little bit about our treasures in heaven and our treasures on earth. So if you guys would all stand as we read God's Word. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. All right, well, here we find out once again. You guys can have a seat. You don't have to stand for the whole sermon, just when I tell you to. All right, well, here we find out once again that our discipleship involves our economics. And we're not just going to talk about our treasure, but we're also going to be talking about our hearts and our worship and our stewardship. And as we dive into this portion of the Sermon on the Mount, you'll notice that this passage is kind of divided into three parallel parts. And they're kind of like three different camera angles all looking at the same issue. Now, all you get, for most of you guys, you know that I love football, particularly University of Texas football. I've got a horns down over there, one back there. Don't be hating. But if you've ever watched a college football game, or any football game for that matter, inevitably at some point, there's going to be a call that was so essential to the outcome of the game and yet somewhat controversial and uncertain that a coach will challenge it. And they'll throw that flag on the field, and then the officials up in the booth will basically review the play from every different camera angle that they have so that they can see everything that happened and make sure they get a certain picture of what really went on so they can get the call right. And that's kind of like what we have going on here. This issue of money and treasure is so important to our discipleship and our understanding of the gospel that Jesus is actually looking at it through a couple, three different camera angles. And he's speaking to it to give us a much fuller view and understanding of how our treasure is going to dictate our discipleship. So, as I said, I'm really excited to dig in this section because I think it's incredibly timely. And it speaks directly into the heart of what our country is really going through in our current recession. And for those of you who aren't aware, I'm going to throw a few statistics at you to bring you up to speed. But in 2008, the stock market was down almost 40%. Unemployment is now up to 7% and still rising. Nationally, home values are down over 20%. American workers lost an average of 27% of their 401k retirement savings in 2008 alone. And since the start of the recession in late 2007, 2.13 million people have been laid off. In Ohio alone, approximately 291,000 people are expected to lose their homes to foreclosure in the next 4 years. So our country is really facing a difficult time, and I'm approaching this topic with a lot of gentleness, yet at the same time with confidence, knowing that Jesus has something to say to us specifically to where we find ourselves. And I know some of you out there are really trying to figure out how do we cling to Jesus in the midst of layoffs, of foreclosures, of ruined credit, of extremely difficult job searches. And you're wondering, where is Jesus in all this, and what am I supposed to do? But I also know that some of you out there are freaking out because God is your money is your God, and your God is dying. And I also know that there's a lot of others out there. You guys probably fall in the college student / hipster group, and you're really not even aware that we're in the midst of a recession because PBR is still $1 a pint down at the local pub. But no matter which section you find yourself in, take heed and listen, because Jesus has a lot to teach us about our worship and about our stewardship. Well, so much for the introduction. Okay, let's just dive in to verse 19 and 20. As here, Jesus presents us with two options of where we may lay up or where we might keep our treasure, on earth or in heaven. On earth, he tells us our treasures are going to be destroyed by moth and rust and stolen by thieves. In heaven, they won't be destroyed and they won't be stolen. You know, I love how Jesus just makes things so blatantly obvious because we're so amazingly dumb. But you read this and you kind of just want to say, well, gee, where should I keep my treasure? I mean, it seems like a better deal in heaven. I mean, they got like climate control up there and mothballs and thieves don't get in. And so, I mean, it seems like a good enough deal. Yet we keep on putting our treasures and laying up hordes and hordes of treasures on earth. And we pursue security in our material luxuries, even though this earth is passing away. And nothing proves this truth of Jesus' words more firmly than the current state of our economy. Now, in verse 19, as I said, Jesus talks about a treasure on earth being lost to moths, rust, and thieves. But we've gotten so good at protecting our treasure. I mean, who is honestly worried about moths anymore? Even our grandparents had mothballs all over the place, right? Smelled like, you know, gross. But even beyond that, we've got mousetraps, we've got exterminators, we've got every different technology to keep out pests. We have stainless steel appliances and undercoating on our cars to keep away the rust. I don't even know what undercoating does. I think it's just a racket. And we've got really sweet security systems to keep the thieves out. And yet, despite all of that, we still find more and more ways to lose our stuff. Now, we've got depreciation, inflation, we've got stock market collapse, we've got all of this. And we keep trying to find out how can we remain financially secure as all of our things keep disintegrating and falling away. Now, don't mishear me and think that I'm saying that it's wrong to try and protect and keep and take care of your things. I'm not saying that at all. It can be actually excellent stewardship to be wise and to look after our stuff and to take care of it. So take care not to ignore this teaching from Jesus because you think he's saying something that he isn't. Actually, in his commentary on the Sermon on the Mount, John Stott answered this question. What is Jesus prohibiting when he forbids us from laying up treasures on earth? And he says, there is no ban on possessions or on private property or on saving or on planning ahead. In fact, throughout the Bible, those actions are commended as being good and wise. But what is prohibited is rather the selfish accumulation of goods. And now my prayer for all of us is that we'd actually believe the words of Jesus here and stop fooling ourselves into thinking that our treasure on earth is secure and lasting. Now, the way in which our earthly treasure can be lost isn't the point here. The fact that it will be lost is. Treasure in this world will be lost despite our wisest efforts, and we can never have secure treasure in a fallen world that's passing away. Sinclair Ferguson wisely said, is that up there? If we think seriously about our possessions, we will realize that they belong to a passing world which offers no security. In fact, seeking security in this world and its possessions is a recipe for producing anxieties rather than relieving them. You see, we all have a deep desire to treasure something, to worship something that is eternal and lasting and secure. And Jesus is so gracious to actually use that desire to draw us to himself and to teach us about truth. And his hope for us is much more than merely saving us the heartbreak when our stuff is stolen. He wants us to treasure what is truly treasure. But we get all upset into the fact that we can't treasure the things of this world, and we get too tied up into looking for a hole in his argument somehow, that we miss the entire point. I mean, we get to lay up treasure in heaven. We've completely missed the fact of what a miraculous reality that is. I mean, we are the very people who have made idols out of his gifts, who have treasured the gifts instead of the giver, and yet in all that, we have been justified by his grace and adopted into God's own family by Jesus' death on the cross. And now he's actually saying that by his grace, we can live in a manner that will actually impact our eternity. But we don't lay up treasure in heaven to hope to build up an account large enough to actually pay our entrance fee, right? But rather, because that entrance fee has already been paid in full, because Jesus' grace has been lavished on us through the cross, we can actually live in a manner that treasures and values those things that are in heaven now and those things that will one day be in heaven with us. But we must start by treasuring Jesus because he is our treasure in heaven. There is no treasure in heaven if we aren't first treasuring Jesus, because all of heaven is for the praise and glory of Christ. So if we aren't treasuring him, we have no hopes of finding enjoyment or treasure in anything else there. So now, how do we lay up treasure in heaven, and what can we lay up there? Well, we'll get a bit more clarity on what this looks like from 1 Timothy 6, verses 17 through 19. So I'll give you guys a second to open up there. As for the rich in this present age, and before you start thinking, oh good, Paul's talking about the rich people, he's not talking to me. By rich here, Paul means American. All right? You with me? So, as for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hope on the uncertainty of riches, right? We just went over all that, how passing and uncertain our riches are, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. They are to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasures for themselves as a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is truly life. So, we who are rich, we can and should enjoy what God has provided for us. We see that clearly in that passage. But we should enjoy what God has provided by stewarding his riches as he has entrusted them to us. We are told that we lay up treasures in heaven by doing good, serving others, being generous, and sharing with those who have nothing. So basically the point is this. You can either use people and love your stuff, or you can use your stuff to love people. All right? Because if you love your stuff, you're just going to use people to get more stuff and to feed that need. But if you love people, then all of your stuff is just going to be a method to love them. So we lay up treasure in heaven by treasuring him who is enthroned there and using our money and our resources and our time and all that we have to love and serve and minister to the people so that they too might treasure Jesus and be there in heaven with us. All right, well, let's move on to that next camera angle. Verse 21 and 22, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The eye is a lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? Well, I included verse 21 with this second section because it's actually a transition verse, and it gives us kind of a context in which we can understand what would otherwise seem to be a couple of verses that are kind of out of context. So frequently throughout Scripture, the eye is synonymous with the heart. And to set your eye on something is quite literally the same as to set your heart on it. So it has to do with our desires and our goals and our purposes and ambitions. So the point here is this, that just as your physical vision guides where our bodies are going, spiritual vision or our heart's desires guide where our lives are going. To have the wrong desire, to be desiring to fill it up with selfish accumulation of stuff, is to actually be wandering in the darkness. Well, that might be making a bit of sense now. What are we to make of that last part of verse 23? If the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? It's like, what? If the light in us is darkness? It's like, that's pretty existential, even for a bunch of emo hipsters, right? It's kind of weird. Well, I think of what he's alluding to is that even if we have the right perspective, if our hearts are desiring after Jesus, if we're treasuring him and wanting to worship him and serve him, we're still surrounded by darkness, namely the desires and values of a fallen world, the temptations of sin, and the deceit of the devil. So even in that situation where we actually have a desire for Jesus and to make him our treasure, we at least have a light to focus on and to guide our walk. But if our desire is actually also for selfish accumulation of goods and blinging it up and just trying to fill yourself with the treasures of this world, then even that is darkness. And so there's no light at all in that picture, and it's complete and utter darkness. And now, I'm really sad to say, because I think that this is actually the state that the majority of the American church, maybe not the majority, but a lot of the American church finds itself in. We know a level of affluence and wealth that has never been known in the history of the church. Christians in the United States have a collective income of over $2 trillion. To put that in a bit of perspective, that means if all of us Christians got together, made a country and seceded from America, I mean, that sets us up for too many jokes, so I'm not even going to go there. But if we all got together, I'm sure it'd be somewhere in the South, and basically made our own country, we would be the 7th or maybe even the 6th wealthiest country in the world. We'd be a member of the G8 for crying out loud. And so we have used that affluence to consume and to lay up hordes and hordes of treasures on earth rather than treasures in heaven. In his book, Passing the Plate, Christian Smith says, "The first and perhaps most formidable rival to the generous voluntary financial giving of American Christians then, in aiding and abetting any of their natural human tendencies towards selfishness and stinginess, is America's institutionalized mass consumerism." He goes on to say, such forces of consumerism are not merely matters of personal values, but are structured into deep-rooted institutions of employment, transportation, media, home ownership, entertainment, and the distribution and selling of masses of discretionary purchases and material luxuries. And yet, it's not only that we've been influenced and tempted by the values of society. I mean, we can expect that, right? But Christians are actually being led there from the pulpit. Pastors all over America are teaching what has become known as the prosperity gospel or the health wealth gospel. And basically, it's just idolatry masquerading as gospel, and it's not good news at all. There are pastors that are telling their people that if you trust Jesus, then all you do, you'll prosper. You'll be totally healthy and never experience pain. You'll be financially prosperous, and all of your relationships will be happy and perfect. People are believing that Jesus died to meet their desire to drive a nicer car, buy a bigger house, and watch a flatter TV. Now, just a brief note, a gospel that can't be preached to the majority of the world is not a gospel. I mean, how do we take this message to a village in Zimbabwe? Trust Jesus and you won't die of cholera. Believe Jesus and your kids won't die of dehydration before your eyes. Come to Christ and you won't get raped and contract AIDS and die. If you really love Jesus enough, then you'll be financially prosperous in a country that has a 94% unemployment rate and, let me get this right, and an inflation rate of 89.7 sextillion percent. I didn't even make that up. That's an actual estimate of the inflation in Zimbabwe. That's 897 with 21 zeros behind it. So just so you know, if you have to measure the rate at which your treasures are collapsing with scientific notation, you got it pretty rough, and you need a gospel that's much deeper than trust Jesus and you'll drive a BMW. You need a gospel that promises an eternal security in heaven. You need a gospel that is secure and lasting, and you need a gospel that takes care of your sin problem and brings you to Jesus and makes him your treasure. And yet, American Christians are believing that if you trust Jesus, he will help you worship your real gods, affluence and comfort. And now that is a message we should all hate. But I think it's a message that we all actually believe. Now, I'm not saying it's wrong to hope for or even pray for a reliable car. Is it wrong to pray for a house with more space? No. A job with better pay? No. To be healed from sickness? No, not at all. Or to have good, loving, solid relationships? No. But what do you think you're entitled to? And when you pray for those things, is it simply to enjoy a higher level of comfort? Or is it so that those things will help you love and worship and treasure Jesus? We must come humbly yet confidently to Jesus, our treasure, and ask him what he would be pleased to graciously give us to meet our needs. Not naming and claiming what we believe we have the right to, like we're some spoiled kid in a department store begging for a toy from our parents. We as American Christians often feel so entitled to make a certain amount of money, live in a certain kind of house, in a certain area of town, to have cars that run properly and toys that work well. And we believe it so intently that we struggle to even, that when we struggle to pay the credit card bill for the stuff that we didn't even need, or when our car breaks down, we cry out, God, why is this happening? What did I do wrong? You guys catch that? Because in those moments, our hearts actually reveal to us how poorly we understand the gospel. And I saw this in my own heart not too long ago. And for those of you who know, I drive a Jeep Cherokee. It's about 10 years old, but I love it. It's a great car. It's so much fun to drive. But evidently, everybody else loves to drive it too, because it's been stolen twice and broken into I don't even know how many times. So I'm really careful now to not leave anything in it overnight. I even have a club that I put on it, you know, like those things that they used 20 years ago. It doesn't really help, but anyway, it's there. It makes me feel, you know, whatever. And the other day I was trying to get to work early because I had a lot to do, and I walk out to my car, open up my door, and I see that my glove compartment's open, stuff is thrown all over the place, and there's glass in the seats. And I got mad. I mean, the whole time I'm thinking, God, why does this keep happening to me? I mean, I'm doing what's right. I'm just trying to get to work to, you know, get by. I don't even have that nice of a car. I mean, it's a 10-year-old Jeep Cherokee, for crying out loud. This shouldn't keep happening to me. I felt entitled. I felt entitled to have stuff that for whatever reason, that it wouldn't happen what Jesus said would happen to. And now I'm not saying that we won't be hurt when we're sinned against. And I'm not saying that we aren't going to be frustrated by a fallen world that has things that break and fail over and over and over again. But what I'm saying is that these things should drive us to Jesus and make us hope for and long for that day that everything's going to be set right. They should illuminate the grace that we experience every day. And you know, there's actually mornings when I walk out to my car and I praise God and I thank him that it's still there. I mean, that's pretty awesome. I mean, it's an amazing thing to be able to recognize God's grace because my car's still there. Now, share a quick story about a guy who got this, who just gets grace way better than I do. Matthew Henry, who was a 17th century British theologian, and he was also a writer of one of the most well-loved commentaries of the Bible, he wrote in his journal once after he was robbed. He wrote this, "Lord, thank you that it was I who was robbed and not I who robbed." I'm going to read that again. "Lord, thank you that it was I who was robbed and not I who robbed." I mean, there is a man who understands grace. I mean, he had just had everything he had on him stolen and taken away. And he went home and praised God that it wasn't him that was taking it. I mean, he got the fact that it was only by God's grace that he wasn't the thief out there breaking in and stealing. I mean, that just blows my mind. I mean, do you realize what abundant grace we experience every day when our car doesn't break down? When you have a job to earn a living, or when you're sheltered from the cold? I mean, we must realize what a blessing it is every day that we aren't plagued with sickness and pain. Our treasures and our blessings are not an entitlement that are ours until we lose it by doing something wrong. They're rather God's gifts to freely give by his grace in spite of all we do wrong. Do you see how much more beautiful that is? How much more Christ exalting that is? I mean, having that perspective lets us see God's grace and to see the cross. Every moment we're actually spared from what we deserve. From what we deserve as sinners. Your possessions are a gift, and you've been entrusted with them to serve and worship God. And God's not there to merely help you get more possessions. Now, to move on to that final verse, that last camera angle, verse 24. "No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money." Now, Jesus doesn't just say that it's unspiritual or not good to serve two masters. He isn't saying that it'll be really hard to keep them balanced. He goes much further, and he gets right to the heart of what's going on, and he says it's impossible. It can't be done. And it can't be done because one of those things will own us completely. Now, if you think you're the exception, and that you found a way, and you found the secret of serving God and money, and sadly you're mistaken, and you're actually only serving one master, and it's not Jesus. Mark Driscoll, he's a pastor in Seattle, and he often says when he's teaching on money, "You can either worship money as your God, or use your money to worship God. Those are the only two options." So you cannot serve God in money. You can either worship money as your God or use your money to worship God. Now we're going to finish up by digging into that last word in the passage. The word translated into the English as money. Does anybody out there have a translation that actually says mammon? Excellent, we got one out there. Cool. Well, mammon comes from a root word that actually means to entrust. And over time, mammon went from the passive meaning of that which is entrusted to the more active meaning of that in which we entrust, and for that in which we trust. Now, I mean, that just blew my mind. So originally mammon meant that which is entrusted. And now it means that in which a man trusts. And so I found the etymology of that word just so illuminating to not only the meaning of this whole passage and all that we're talking about, but really to the whole heart of our sin with materialism. Our stuff, all of our stuff, not just 10% of our stuff, but all of our stuff is entrusted to us from God, and is to be steward to him and invested according to his purpose, his agenda, and what he desires. So our question shouldn't ever be, God, how much of my stuff do I have to give back to you? But rather, how much of your stuff would you allow me to take care of my needs for? And yet we have stolen what has been entrusted to us, and we have chosen to trust in our stuff, hoping that it will save us. I mean, are you guys starting to get how amazingly gracious Jesus' teaching here is? Don't trust in your stuff. I'm telling you, it will break, it will fall apart, it'll be stolen, it'll be lost. Set your eye and heart on me. I died for you. I redeemed you. Trust in me, and then no matter what happens to your stuff, your treasure will be in heaven, where it will never break, where it will never lose value, where it will never be taken from you. You guys, we have an eternal treasure. And his name is Jesus. Now, this is good news. And every week we celebrate it by remembering the death and the resurrection of Jesus, our treasure, in communion. And on the night Jesus was betrayed, he took a loaf of bread and he broke it. Saying, "This is my body broken for you. Take this in remembrance of me." In the same way, he took a cup and he said, "This is my blood of the new covenant, sealed by the shedding of my blood. For every time you eat this bread and drink this cup, you're announcing my death until I return." So if you're a Christian, come forward and proclaim Jesus' death for you. But if you're not a Christian, we don't want to exclude, we aren't trying to make this a set-apart thing, but take the time to really consider where is your treasure, who is your treasure? And think through that deeply, think through that soberly. And we don't want to be exclusive, but the taking of the body and bread, taking communion, is something that's reserved for Christians, because by doing that, we're actually identifying ourselves with what the bread and with what the cup symbolize, which is the death of Christ. So go ahead and come forward as one body. And this is also a time for us to worship by giving our finances. This is a time where we can actually lay up treasure in heaven. Not so that we can have nicer bling and so the pastor can drive nicer stuff, but so that we can actually serve the poor, serve the community, minister and worship God, and lay up treasure in heaven. And so let me encourage you, those of you who aren't Christians, to allow that as we come forward, this be a time for you to consider deeply and to think on who is Jesus to you, who is your treasure, and if you choose to make him your treasure, you know, let me know. Talk to somebody you came with, and we'll talk you through that and help you understand and process through what all that means so that you can join with us and take communion next week. So let me pray. Lord, you are our treasure. Lord, we're the very ones who make idols out of your gifts, who love stuff, who consume at a rate that the world has never known. And yet you died that you might be our treasure, that we actually might have lasting treasure and might be secure in a world that's passing away. Jesus, we love you. We praise you for that. And we just thank you for your graciousness and just the constant provision you give us, that we never actually get what we deserve in this world, and that, in fact, we are constantly surrounded by evidences of your grace and your love and your provision. Lord, let us be amazed by that and be moved to worship, to be moved to treasure you, to be moved to steward all that you entrust us with in a manner that brings honor and glory to your name and brings those who don't yet know you into your kingdom so that you might be their treasure. Amen.